This is the Homebrew Game Club, a podcast about brand new aftermarket games for retro consoles. My name is Nick, also known as Divertov, and I'm here with my co-hosts Bart and Connor to talk to a very special guest, Kevin Hanley. Kevin is one of the most well-known names in the NES homebrew community. As a host of the Assembly Line podcast, he and Bo Holland opened the door for many new folks to learn about NES homebrew development and inspired many new homebrewers to enter the scene. Kevin is also a developer himself, and since the late 2000s, he has released numerous ports and original works to the NES under the moniker Kahan Games, including such well-known titles as Study Hall, The Incident, Ultimate Frogger Champion, Larry and the Long Look for a Luscious Lover, and most recently, Nescape, an escape room game that we covered on our podcast way back on episode number 4, back in March 2022. That was a year ago. Nescape is recently out on the Nintendo Switch and Xbox, and Kevin has graciously joined us to talk about that game today and his other work. Kevin Hanley, thank you for coming on our show today.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yes. I am very excited. I just want to say, I am such a huge fan of yours. Oh my gosh.
No, I don't believe it. I don't think you are. I think you're lying.
No, it's true. I got to tell you. So the Assembly Line is the only podcast that I have ever listened to every episode at least twice.
Oh, wow.
Every single episode. Yeah. And some of them more than that. And so, yeah, seriously. We got a real parasocial relationship going on here, I just want to say. Like, we've had lots of conversations in my car, and you don't know that, but we've totally gotten into it, seriously. So,
are we disagreeing in these conversations?
I don't know, man. Seriously, they were epic, but yeah.
Well, that's really nice to hear.
Disagreeing the first time that you listen to it, agreeing the second time you listen to it, maybe.
That's right. Yeah, that's why I was going back for a second take. I'm like, hold on.
That's hilarious.
No, it's just fun. So for like me personally, this is like my entire homebrew journey coming full circle. I'm now interviewing you on my podcast, so my homebrew podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm stoked for this.
Great. Okay, let's just kick right into it here. I got a lot of questions. I don't know if we're going to get to all of these, but so how did you get interested in game development and NES development specifically? Do you have a background in programming?
No. So after college, I decided I wanted to... One of my coworkers at the time, I worked at a newspaper. He was like, man, I found all these Nintendo games under my bed. And I was like, that's cool. I used to play Nintendo. I'd like to take a look at those. He's like, you can have them. So he gave me these box of like 60 NES games. And this was like 2005, 2006.
Oh, nice.
So I was like, man, I wonder how many games there are for this system. So I looked up on the internet, and Nintendo Age wasn't around at this time, but a precursor to Nintendo Age, NES World, was around, and there was a list, and I was like, oh man, 776 games. I wonder if I can collect them all. So started collecting NES games, and then right around 2006, Nintendo Age came along with an actual sub-forum on that site for homebrews. And at this time, NES homebrew was really, really in its infancy, but one of the main guys who was posting on the forum was known as Bunny Boy, who ran a website called RetroZone. And his claim to fame was offering NES adapters so you could play NES games on your computer with an emulator, but using a real NES controller. And he started posting these tutorials for how to program for the NES. Right around this time, I had moved to Dallas, and the economy crashed right around this time, and I could not find a job to save my life. I was putting in hundreds of applications, getting no callbacks, getting crazy depressed, and these tutorials sort of gave me something to focus on, because I had always wondered, like, how are games made? Like, what does that even look like? I couldn't really visualize it. So looking at these tutorials, it sort of gave me something to focus on, and it gave me sort of an in to understand how game development was done. So I just took one tutorial at a time and sort of just taught myself assembly language, which modern day programmers hear that and they think I'm nuts because it's such an archaic language. I mean, it's one step above ones and zeros. You're typing in these very basic commands, and when you compile it, it changes it into ones and zeros. But I didn't know any better, so I just sort of dug in and haven't really looked back since.
That's great. Oh, so I want to ask you specifically about Netscape, because this has just been ported to Switch and Xbox. And of course, we covered this on our podcast, and we were just talking about this the other day. The probably the most fun that we have had so far with this podcast is we did a live stream of Netscape, where we all got together, and I, like, Bart brought his wife, I brought my wife, we got another friend, and I mean, we took it like we were going to a real escape room. Like, we went out, we got some sushi, we had a few drinks, you know, and we all came back, and we had this studio set up, you know, I mean, it felt like going to a club or something. Yeah. But I mean, we took it on. We wanted to beat this game in real time over the internet. And I, that's exactly what it felt like. It felt like a real escape room. What was your inspiration for this game? Are you a fan of escape rooms?
That is probably the understatement of the year. So every year on my birthday, my friends know what's up. I'm dragging them to an escape room. It's probably the only time all year my friends do it, but I am fanatical about them. I do all of them that I can. So I never considered that anything like this would be possible on the NES. But at, like, the third year we went, I started, like, I was in between projects and I was like, man, I wonder if I could take any of these ideas and, like, make them work. Because the NES is so, it's such an archaic system. It has severe limitations. Like, what can you even do to make a fun experience? So
yeah.
I didn't really have a lot of ideas, but I went to my friend, my local friend Kendall's house. She previously was just my photographer. She would take pictures of my games for my website to when I went to sell my games. So I just very vaguely asked her, you know, if you were to play an escape room video game, like, what might the first puzzle look like? And then, like, 4 hours later, we had the entire game mapped out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I didn't intend for us to figure the entire game out that night, but we just sort of went, and one idea led to another, and we just didn't stop. So visually, I still had no idea how it would work, but we had some cool ideas, and it got the ball rolling. So yeah, I definitely never expected and never thought that a group of people, like, I was just thinking of like a single player experience, but after the game released and I saw some videos of multiple people playing it and having friends over and seeing a group of people playing it at the same time, that is definitely the most fun, because everyone thinks they know the correct solution and they're yelling out, you know, what the person holding the controller should be doing. And it's right. Never right, but it's so much fun to witness, for sure.
You know, you're talking about adapting an escape room for the NES and the constraints of the NES. And I was listening to when we did this a year ago, I was listening to our podcast about it. And we started comparing it to like a point and click adventure game. And I think Bart had said like Myst or something like that, which is really just a thing where you're just walking around and doing like little escape room kind of puzzles, you know? Do you think there's a comparison there to point and click? Because I know that's a genre that you've had a lot of experience with.
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that point and clicks are my jam. I grew up, you know, my first system was a PC. My dad brought home a computer in like 90 or 91. So a lot of my original game exposure was King's Quest, Space Quest, Leisure Suit Larry, like all the Sierra, you know, Monkey Island, that kind of stuff. So when we started talking about wanting to do this escape room game, I wanted the control scheme to be very basic. You know, you're moving a cursor, you're pushing a single button to do what needs to be done, and that's it. Like, you don't need to know anything else. So yeah, I definitely was inspired by point and click adventures, and just the way the controls are, I really wanted it to be simplified like that. So I think it turned out pretty well.
I can say I'm also a huge fan of point and click adventure puzzles, and I'm also a huge fan of escape rooms. I've done quite a few of them, and the sense of satisfaction that was in the room was just palpable every time we solved the puzzle, and the sense of frustration. Which brings me, you know, to the question about the slide puzzle. that thing, wow, that was awesome. But it was
is that the right word you want to use? Awesome.
Yeah, we'll say awesome, because it was just oh man, that was a point where we were kind of like But for as soon as we finally solved it and like moved on, I could just, it was like the entire room erupted, like it was a goal at the Super Bowl or something. It was amazing.
Right. Well, I don't know. And I have to update our listeners here. So what Bart is referring to on the live stream, we actually had a technical issue where every time we would try to solve the slide puzzle, it would glitch out. It had something to do with my EverDrive or the analog. And so we actually did solve the slide puzzle like twice and it didn't take. So what we figured out is you had to solve the slide puzzle without it making any mistakes, like move by move perfectly. And thankfully, Kevin was in the live stream chat and just fed us the answers move by move. And that is the only way that we managed to get through the puzzle. Otherwise, we would have had to stop the live stream because we could not have continued. So, yeah. Definitely, I'm going to say, if as a tip, if you're playing this game at home, you get to the slide puzzle, it really helps to have Kevin Hanley in the chat.
It's so funny. I remember saying a story while we were actually doing it. My dad used to have a slide puzzle that he let me play with when I was a kid. It was a little like Dukes of Hazzard. It was about this big. And he used to tell me that when he would wake up to go to work, he would sit down super tired and he would drink his coffee and solve the slide puzzle in like 3 minutes. And then the rest of the day, he could never solve it. He's like, the only time I could ever solve it was right when I first woke up, and it was like maybe a different part of my brain was controlling things. It was really crazy, but it's that was such a memorable night. I loved it. So
we have to do it again where the people are all playing at that time of day. That's the only way we'll be able to get through.
Right.
5:30 in the morning. That's it.
Yeah, that's probably the puzzle I got the most flack for. When John, my artist, when he initially drew it, he had it in a 3x3 grid. So it was going to be easier. And I thought, this is way too easy. Let's make it 4x3. That's not bad, right? So we probably should have stuck with the original idea. I didn't really understand the hatred. I didn't know that there was such hatred of slide puzzles, but I've gotten cursed at many times.
I was going to ask if you just had a thing for slide puzzles, or maybe you just have a sadistic streak or what?
No, but, I mean, when Kendall and I were coming up with everything, we were just trying to think of every type of puzzle we could. And that's just one of the ones we thought, we'd remembered. So we tried to put it in.
In fairness, in your defense, I think the glitch was more of an issue than the puzzle itself. I think
absolutely.
That was probably
right. It was a hard word.
I hated to see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but like we could have a whole episode talking about the fidelity of these games in certain contexts or certain environments. So I don't want to digress too much there. But I imagine that was an interesting one to put together as well, right? So. To code, I mean, I've never seen a slide puzzle game in an NES before, so like, I guess that was kind of novel to do that.
Yeah, as I was coding that game, Bo, who I do the Assembly Line podcast with, he was like, "You're insane for wanting to do this because every puzzle is essentially a new game engine by itself, and trying to cram all that into, an NES cartridge which has memory, constraints itself." It was a fun challenge for sure.
Well, how did you come up with the various puzzles in the game? Because you're saying every puzzle was basically its own game engine. I hadn't really thought about that. That is a complication. So were there other puzzles that maybe you wanted to use, but you just threw out because they were too challenging or
no? Honestly, everything that our initial ideas of what we came up with. Everything made it in, which is kind of insane thinking about it, in that context. I never stopped to consider maybe something wouldn't work. And honestly, there probably are puzzles we should have cut. Like the audio puzzles are probably better in theory than in practice because, the compression of trying to get the bit rate down enough to fit, on a cartridge. At a certain point, it just becomes inaudible. But damn it, we came up with the idea in advance, and I wasn't about to cut it.
Was it? So it wasn't. I was wondering if that was intentional that they're so compressed, and it's not. Okay, huh?
No.
That was one of the benefits of us playing it with a big group because there were like, I think it was Nick, was it your wife that, like, when those came on, she just was like, oh, that.
Well, yeah, No. She's amazing. Well, she works with, yeah, she's got a degree in childhood education. So she works with little kids and they have to, like, decipher, you know, baby talk. And so that was, like, for some reason, like, she was able to hear this stuff and she just immediately got it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's wild. Well, that's what I say, because you play it with a group and everybody brings something different to the table. You know, like, we all solved a different puzzle. Yeah, that was the thing. Like, I said, if I had played this solo, I probably would never beat it because I just thought it was too challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a question. How do you gauge the difficulty of some of these puzzles? Because you said you kind of designed it as a single player experience. And so, I mean, to me, like, I found it entirely too difficult as a single player game, but playing as a group, it was a totally different experience. How do you gauge the difficulty then?
It's tough, because me personally, I love puzzle games and I love being challenged. So we wanted to err on the side of too difficult. Whether that was the right call, who knows? At the end of the day, I'm going to design a game that I personally want to play, and I sort of take the licks afterward as I do. I mean, if people don't vibe with it, I hate it, but, you know, everyone has different skill sets and what they consider fun. So I just thought, am I going to enjoy this? Yes. Okay. Putting it in, moving on.
Talk about vibing with it. Man, I think I just wanted to restate, this is the most fun I've ever had playing a Nintendo game with a group of people.
Oh, man, that's full stop. So nice to hear.
So, yeah, thank you. I loved it.
Well, and I think, you know, I mean, you talk about difficulty, but as a group, I mean, I think we probably would have beaten it. You know, we were trying to beat it in real time to beat the timer, and I think we might have gotten there if it hadn't have been for the technical glitches. We would have gotten real close.
Honestly, that's the perfect sort of benchmark, because when you go into a real escape room, you're usually, if you do beat it, you're beating it right at the buzzer. And in a perfect world, everyone in the group will have contributed something to get out in the end. So the fact that you all solved different parts of it and probably would have if the glitches wouldn't have happened, like, that means the world to me. I'll consider it a success just from that.
It's great.
For me, it's also an extra dimension knowing that you are a big fan of escape rooms and, you know, knowing that you've kind of put in all these elements from maybe a bunch of different escape rooms that you've been through. To me, it's kind of like somebody who's a big fan of, you know, detective novels or something like Agatha Christie. And, like, you've, you know, read every Poirot or every whatever it is, and you're like, okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to make my own version, put a spin on it, do it in the NES. And, like, that's kind of, you know, that's the vibe I got from it, where it's like you're kind of doing your own, like, best of, because it absolutely is, like, lots of different elements. But I'm sure for you, you're looking at these puzzles going like, oh, yeah, that reminds me of this other one that I was in back in 2019 or this other escape room that I went to with these guys. And maybe you get that element as well. So, like, when you see someone playing, or if you are playing the game even yourself, do you get some memory or some, like, recall of times you've been in those escape rooms or in similar kind of, you know, puzzles?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a few that I directly, there have been slide puzzles in escape rooms that I've done. So I definitely took specific puzzles from different escape rooms that I've done. A lot of them weren't. I mean, a lot of them were just sort of puzzle ideas that we knew of that we just wanted to sort of bring in. But yeah, definitely watching people play through it, I definitely recall specific memories of previous escape rooms we've done.
So I want to ask about getting your game on the Nintendo Switch and the Xbox, which, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. It's been a dream of mine to have a game on a modern Nintendo console. So never thought it would be a thing, but I'm so blown away.
I've talked to other homebrewers, and it's like, you get that eShop listing, and it's like, I have a licensed Nintendo game. You know?
It's real. Like, you go to Nintendo.com and there it is. Like, it's just so crazy.
What was the process for getting your game ported over there? Because I feel like I saw you going back and forth on this for a long time on Twitter, I believe. Was it challenging?
It's a struggle, man. It's a struggle. I know some modern languages a bit, but I'm not affluent enough to program in the languages that these modern consoles require. So I had to sort of seek out an expert to take what I've done and make it work. And being able to find someone, one, willing, but two, like motivated enough to do it was a real challenge, because back when I released the incident, and I don't know what year that was, 2017 or something, there was a guy who was taking homebrews and porting them to iPhone. And I hired him to essentially take the incident and make it work. And he was working on it, but then he just straight up like ghosted me and wouldn't respond to any of my messages. And it was like really kind of maddening, because I really wanted my games to be on some sort of modern device. So I'm pretty good friends with the guys from Retrotainment, the guys who did the Haunted Halloween games and the new game Fall Quiet.
Fall Quiet, yes.
So they have another sort of venture. Tim from that company has another venture called 8-Bit Legit Games. So they have been taking some of their homebrews and some other homebrews and porting them to modern systems. So he approached me about doing any escape. And of course, you know, I'm like, dude, if you want to do this 100%, I'm on board, because this has been my dream. So it was a long process, because they have a lot on their plate. They just did that Garbage Pail Kids game. And, you know, they always have, and they're trying to finish up Full Quiet. So getting any escape across the finish line, it felt like it was never going to happen. And there were so many times that I was just like, you know, can I cuss on this? Fuck it, you know.
Oh yeah, you absolutely.
Let's pull the plug. I don't want this. I don't want this shit. I'm too tired of waiting.
Yeah.
But they came through in the end, so I'm so happy. I mean, seeing it on Xbox, and honestly, like the reviews that have come out, you never know how a puzzle game is going to be reviewed, because like everyone has a different, like I said, a different sort of threshold on what the fun / I hate this difficulty, you know, that factor is. So a majority of the reviews have been positive, which I didn't expect, truthfully. So seeing it, one, come out, but two, be as well received, and three, sell as well as it did.
Oh, good.
All three exceeded my expectations tremendously.
That's great. I dropped out there for a second, so I apologize if I'm misunderstanding. But did you talk to somebody about porting the incident to mobile?
Yeah, so that was my first sort of trying to get one of my games on some sort of modern device. So yeah, there was a guy that did, I want to say, Battle Kid and maybe Zooming Secretary on iOS.
Okay.
So I reached out to him and I was like, hey man, I have this game. I think it might do well. You know, can I hire you to do this? And he was like, yeah. And he worked on it for a couple months and like actually had it working. And there, I think the test app on iOS is called, I don't remember at this point, but it was working, but he's just disappeared before we could actually get it in the app store. So it really sort of pissed me off, but you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. I think it's interesting you say that, cause I had, our other friend who played with us when we did the live stream, said he would have liked to play this as a mobile game.
Really?
Netscape. Yeah. I guess maybe the point and click stuff, you know?
But, yeah, I don't. I mean, honestly, I took the control scheme from. I played a couple of mobile escape rooms, the Cube Escape series. I don't know if you guys have seen that. There's a series of games by a company called Rusty Lake. They do a bunch of different Cube Escape games, and they're all sort of escape rooms. So I was big into those, and just the simplified control scheme of just tapping. I wanted to, you know, mimic that. So I think it would do well on mobile, but I don't know anyone that's sort of taking homebrews and making them work for the mobile devices. So I would love to. If anyone's listening and can do it, reach out.
Yeah, that might be a new venture for somebody. We're the iOS homebrew guys. Yeah. Okay, so now that I got you here, I have to ask. So I'm looking at your website right now, and Netscape. So I went on and on. I think the cartridge, the physical release that you guys did was really beautiful. It had, you know, this really nice blue card and this cool label from Peekaboos. And I'm looking at it now, and I'm like, man, I sure would like to get one of those. And it is $999.99 on your website. Is that actual, like, is it, if somebody paid you $1,000, would you sell another release of this? I just want to know if this is real. Like, is this an actual offer? Because I have a question coming up. I did want to ask you, because some of your games go for astronomical prices on eBay, on the resale market. What is that like, seeing games that you made go for that much?
It's sort of a double-edged sword. I mean, it's nice thinking that someone might value something I've done at that, you know, that high, but on the other side of it, thinking of someone actually spending that much money on something I did, it honestly embarrasses me a little. Like, I would hate for someone to spend that kind of money. The first game that I did, the Ultimate Frogger Champion, the limited edition version of that I did some like pink, I called it the Lady Frog edition, did these pink boxes. And for a while, that was the most valuable NES homebrew. They're going for like 1500 or something. And it was just silly. Like, I didn't understand why anyone, I mean, it's cool, it's a collector's item, but like, it's just Frogger. Like, why would you do it? So to answer your question, no, the version on my website that's listed at $1,000, it's not a real offer.
Okay.
I wanted, people were going there trying to figure out how to get the digital version, the ROM, and I offer it on itch.io. So I wanted to get some sort of like, I wanted to put something up to get attention to like, oh, I'm going to click on this. Why would I pay $1,000? Oh, wait, let me read this. Okay, here's a link to itch.io. So I would like to re-release it because there is still some demand. You know, there are people out there that are wanting to buy any escape. It's just so hard. It takes a lot out of me to buy all the parts and put everything together and shipping and international shipping. And it's just such a headache. So there are a couple publishers that have reached out to me that have asked, you know, can we re-release this? And honestly, I would love for someone to re-release it, but no one has actually like gone through with it. So I think I will at some point this year put together maybe another 100 copies or something and see how that does. And
oh, cool.
Maybe if there is a bigger demand, I'll put more together, but it's just so much work, man. When we did that Kickstarter, I think we had to put together 450 copies, and we did it over the course of a weekend. John flew down from Michigan and Kendall came over, and the three of us just knocked it out. But it's like full days worth of work to flash the cart, assemble the cart, put it in a box, you know, get it together, put tape on it, print a label. And then like dealing with getting it to the post office is just, it gives me stress just thinking about it.
Wow. Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, the resale market for homebrew has just gone bananas lately. I mean, that's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, and the guys like Broke Studio, who constantly have their stuff in stock, like I don't understand how they handle it. Like, I can't just stock 1,000 and 2,000, you know, parts to have on hand at a time. I just can't do that. So I do smaller batches, and it sells out, and that's what leads to higher, you know, resale values. And I would love to continually offer them, but I can't do it. It's too much work.
It's just wild to me that there's that kind of demand now for homebrew.
It's getting bigger every year. You know, when Nintendo Age went away, we were wondering, because for the longest time, that was the central hub where you would go to get information and where the enthusiasts were. And when that sort of centralized community went away, we didn't know, like, is homebrew going to die? Because there's nowhere to go to like meet up and get excited about new projects. But it's been crazy. Twitter seems like it sort of took over. All the developers just started posting there about their stuff. And then podcasts popped up and Discord servers popped up. And it just, every year it's getting bigger and bigger. Big projects are coming out, like Micromages. And when that happens, more people come in. And it's just not going away. It's getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask about, you mentioned Frogger several times. So you do a lot of ports to the NES as well as your original games. So you got Frogger, you've got E.T., you got Scramble. So do you have any other ports planned? Do you ever worry about about the owners of the IP taking action? Because you got some of those are Konami games.
Yeah. So a lot of my early joy of making games for the NES was taking some of my favorite games from other systems and bringing them to the NES, because the NES at the end of the day is my favorite system. I grew up with it. You know, I just have the warm fuzzies when I think about it. So yeah, I do have a couple other ports planned. I wanted to port over the first King's Quest. Ooh. So I started doing that myself. But then Jordan Davis got with me and he was like, "Hey man, I want to do the graphics for this game." And so he started doing awesome. Some of the other backgrounds. So I think we have a majority of those backgrounds done, but I just haven't had the time to go in and actually program the game. So I'd like to do that. As for companies coming after me, there's certainly always a fear. And funny story, I think it was actually Any Escape. When that game came out, I had a company reach out to me because they wanted to review the game. So I said, yeah, I'll send you a copy of the game so you can check it out. And I think like that weekend came and I went to South Florida to go to a Weezer concert. And the company was like bombarding me on Twitter like, "Hey, like, have you shipped this out?" And I'm like, "Why are you rushing me, man? Like, I'll get it to you when I can get to you. Like, I'm trying to enjoy life right now." So they got like legitimately pissed off at me and like went and said, "I'm emailing Konami and telling them that you're making illegal copies of your game." Like, they went out of their way to try to like get me busted. And
what an asshole.
I'm sure Konami got that and they're like, "You know, we're not doing anything with this game." And what did he sell? A couple hundred copies? Like, who cares? So luckily, nothing has ever come back to me.
Oh, that's good.
So yeah, I've been very lucky. Haven't had any legal action, but yeah, there's always a risk. But I don't let it stop me.
Okay, so just for the record, is it NES Escape, or because we've been saying
that's what I call it? But just like my company name, Kahan Games, I've given up. People can call me Con Games. Yeah. People can call it Nescape. Whatever. It's whatever.
Yeah, we did. I think we had a con joke about that. Yeah. you gotta pull out the Star Trek thing. So it's
yeah. Oh yeah. Just
yeah. William Shatner, Kahan.
Right. Yeah, I should have thought one that a little bit more through when I was stylizing how I spelled my name. But at this point, rolling with the punches.
So I got to say, when we got together for the first time to do anything that we published after we launched our social media accounts as the Homebrew Game Club, the first thing that we ever put up was an absolutely terrible like cell phone video. We got together and live streamed Bart here beating E.T., your port of E.T. to the NES. He beat it in about 20 minutes after not having played it in something 35 years. What inspired you to port E.T. of all games, this historically maligned Atari 2600 game, to the NES?
I think that anyone that says the game is terrible doesn't understand the game.
Yes. Thank you.
It is a severely misunderstood game, and I think some of the controls on the Atari are a little sloppy, but I think it's a great game. So when I was finishing up Leisure Suit, with Leisure Suit Larry, which honestly, that was my goal as an NES programmer. I want to get Leisure Suit Larry ported to the NES because it was my favorite game as a kid. And I was like having like weird fears of dying before I finished it. Like it was, I went to like some dark places when I was finishing up that game. Anyway, when I was finishing the game, I started thinking of like, what fun things can I do with this? And I started remembering like back in the day when you'd get like comic books or whatever, it would come with like, there would be a page where there would be like an order form to send in and get like cool, like posters or t-shirts. And I thought, man, I'm going to put like an order form in to like, I don't know, for something. And then I thought, well, what can I do? And at the time, I don't even remember specifically how E.T. came on my radar, but like, I thought, I'd like to port this. Like I enjoy the game and it's just, it might be easy to do quickly. So I spent like a few weekends just porting the game over because it's a pretty simple game.
Yeah.
But I like it. So I finished porting it and I thought, you know what? offer this game through mail-in order. You have to mail me the form, and I will build you the cartridge for ET, and I will ship it to you. So I thought maybe I would get 50 copies, but I swear to God, it seems like every single person that bought Leisure Suit Larry ordered two copies of ET through the mail. I can't believe how many copies of that game are floating around now. But yeah, I sold so many ETs.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's clearly the fidelity was impressive, because Bart had not played that game in 35 years. And he, like I said, he was able to knock it out in 20 minutes. So
that's great. Yep. It's good to know someone played it.
Oh, yeah. I love that. I love that game. I have been defending that game for 35 years. Every time it comes up, and it's just like, oh, yeah, ET killed the video. Actually, it's because you didn't read the instruction manual and you just don't know how to play it. And it's just like, I just go off in these long tangents, and people are like, okay, dude.
Well, I will concede that it, like, when you're going in hoping for like some sort of movie ET experience, it's nothing like that. So I can understand how someone would be taken aback of like, what does this have to do with ET? But like, the game itself is a fun game.
Yeah.
All right. I have to ask you about the assembly line, because I have to say, like, we would not be sitting here right now if I had not listened to the assembly line over and over and over again and had it inspire me to do my own podcast about homebrew games. So, you know, going back and listening to the assembly line now, because you guys started, I don't remember, I should have looked this up when you started that podcast, but it feels like going back now and going back to like way back to episode one when you guys did Battle Kid, it feels almost like an oral history of the NES homebrew scene, and going all the way through several years up to a certain point when you guys, I guess you stopped posting regularly maybe a couple of years ago now. But how do you feel like the scene has changed just in the last couple of years? Do you think it's gone in different ways? I mean, it feels like it's just all over the place now.
It's been interesting seeing the different phases that things have gone. So, you know, when I started, it was a lot of people just sort of figuring things out. So the projects were a lot smaller and looked way worse. But then people started getting their footing, and, you know, you had games like Leisure Suit Larry come out and Mad Wizard, and you had these like full experiences. Then the forums died, but then like Kickstarter projects started coming out. So it's gotten bigger and bigger, but then like NES Maker came out and we were worried, like, is there going to be a crap ton of shovelware that it's going to like overshadow, you know, the projects that we were thinking were good. But of course, all those fears are put aside now, because everyone's making great games. But it's been crazy seeing the progression. I think games now are better than they've ever been. And it seems like every project that's coming out seems to be top tier. I mean, far surpassing the best of the licensed era. So I think the best is yet to come. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just great seeing the direction things are going.
Yeah, it just seems like there's just a new, like, super high quality release now every couple of months. Like, just really top tier stuff.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about Nestmaker, because that was, I remember you guys on the podcast had a little bit of, I guess, reservations when that first came out. But it, you know, you're talking about making a game with Jordan Davis, who got into homebrew through Nestmaker. So I guess your kind of take on that has changed over time as well.
It's been weird. You know, when we were getting into it, everyone was doing it the hard way, programming it in assembly. Mm. And then some people released some tools in the C programming language to make it a little bit more accessible for more people to make games. So yeah, when the NES Maker software came out, we didn't really know what to expect, but we were, I guess I should only speak for myself. I was a little worried that just anyone was going to be able to get it into it now. And I don't necessarily want to say quality control, but like, there's a lot of, when you look at like the Steam store or the Xbox store, like there's just a lot of crap out.
Or the eShop.
And I was like, man, like, is this how NES homebrew is going to be now? Like, our projects are going to get overshadowed by thousands of half-baked ideas that people could just throw together in NES Maker. And when things started out, there was a little of that. Like, people were making Kickstarter campaigns for every little game that they thought that they could put together and trying to cash in. And I, you know, people can do what they want to do. I don't want to dissuade them from doing that, but it was a worry. So when Bo and I were trying to think of, like, what can we do to point people in the direction of the games we would consider more good or, you know, more valuable. So we were first toying with the idea of, like, putting together, like, a homebrew committee where we could, like, not we, but, like, people could award some sort of seal of quality to a homebrew game to, like, sort of show which ones were the cream of the crop. But what we wound up settling on was starting a podcast called The Assembly Line, where we could feature the games that we thought were, you know, worth looking at.
Yeah.
And my opinion personally of the NES Maker software, I've softened a lot in the past few years because there are legitimately some great games that are being released using that software. And it's bringing a lot of quality people who maybe started with that software, have gotten more involved in the community and seeing how else they can be involved and sort of grouping up with some of us who were doing it from the old guard. So I think it's just all around a win-win situation, because at the end of the day, it's getting more people interested in NES homebrew. It's getting more people involved, and it's just, we're all here for the right reasons. We just want to play fun games.
Yeah, that's great. You know, say you're talking about Assembly Line is kind of a way to highlight what's good in the community. That's exactly why I started looking for podcasts on it, because it was, I remember back then, you know, pretty much the only place that you could go for information about NES homebrew was Nintendo Age. And if you weren't used to web forums, you know, which is, it was kind of something that I always sort of stayed away from. It was just, it was really hard to know where to start. And so, yeah, that's exactly why I started listening to Assembly Line. So you guys really,
mission accomplished,
really hit it on the head with that one.
I did have one quick follow-up on the, like, you know, Assembly Line helping to kind of, like, give an entry point to people and kind of showcase good games. There's actually been an increase, I think, now in the number of people who want to showcase games, right? So this is, like, to me, it feels like a very pendulum effect, right? So there's, you know, it swings over to people being able to make a lot of games. And so then it starts to swing over towards the editorial side of people wanting to kind of, like, you know, classify or showcase these games in a better light. And so when I see things like, oh, I don't know, like, you know, the retro top 250 NES homebrews and, you know, things that are kind of coming out now that are more, you know, stating, you know, this is the canonical list. I mean, I just want to point out, I don't think there's a solution to, like, one perfect version of it, but it just feels like there's a pendulum swinging back and forth, right? And so it swings over to making things easy to make and opening up the audience to a greater, you know, audience developers, versus then opening up the audience to people who want to learn more about homebrew and who want to, like, get into it and who hear the buzz. Where do you feel that pendulum is right now? Is it more like we're on the side of, like, people finding out about it and wanting to play it, or are we on the side of there's a lot more interest in development and ways to kind of make these games?
I think we're somewhere in the middle. I think that we're getting more write-ups than we've ever gotten before. There are a lot of publications that are picking up on what we're doing. So I think exposure-wise, we're probably as good as we've ever been. A lot of big names are starting to see that what we're doing and wanting to write up about it. You bring up that top 250 list, and I have so many conflicted feelings about that list, because, I mean, dude has a million followers. Awesome. But, like, who is he to come in and start, like, ranking games? Like, I don't know. That was a whole mess right there. But yeah, I think at the same time, really, really great projects like Orange Island, like some of these big are being developed. So I think on both sides of both the exposure and development, the big, huge things are happening. And that's honestly why I think, like, this is the golden age of NES homebrew. Like, it could go in so many directions right now. But I think good is the direction it's going. Like, I'm really excited to see what comes next.
Before we kind of gravitate away from assembly line, I have to ask, what is the future like for the podcast? Is Bo coming back? Because I know you've been doing, over the last few episodes, you've been doing more like deep dives with various game developers. Is there a plan to ever bring Bo back, kind of go back to your old format, or what's the future hold for the assembly line?
So the reason Bo stopped being able to do them is because he and his wife had a daughter. So his time was completely consumed with that, which as it should be. I mean, he's a new father for the first time and he's sort of figuring things out. And plus they just bought this house and he's doing a lot of renovations. So he didn't have a lot of free time. So when I noticed that, you know, some time had passed, I was like, I don't want this to just die. Like I think that what we've done is good and I want to keep it going. So I was trying to think of some way that I could continue to make episodes, but at the same time, not like Bo is half of the assembly line and I can't do it without him. So I wanted to think of sort of like a different way to approach things. So that's when I came up with the idea for Dev Bites, bringing on a developer, asking them their process, you know, how do they do things? Because everyone on the development side of things, everyone does things differently. Some people, you know, use Notepad, some people like text editors, or like so many different graphics programs, so many different compilers. So like getting, you know, direct feedback on the nitty gritty of how people do things was fun for me. And I figured, you know, if other people like it, cool. But at the same time, that's starting to die down because like I don't know if you guys run into this, but like trying to nail down interviews is a pain in my ass. Like reaching out and like people saying like, yeah, I'm interested, but like have a lot going on right now. And like getting like soft no's, it's like, it's just so frustrating. So I got like four people that I really wanted to bring on. And none of them really like helped me lock down a time. So I was just like, fuck it, man. I don't want to do this if it's this much work just to get someone on.
Yeah.
So right now I'm in the sort of like, I don't know what to do because I would like to keep doing it, but it's just so much work to try to like even get someone to set down a specific time to come on and talk.
Yeah. Scheduling is a giant pain in the ass. Just getting like the three of us together is tough.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine with this many hosts.
Yeah.
Well, and now in different countries.
Yeah. Like when we were all in St. Louis, like it wasn't a big deal. Cause like we were all just hanging out, but now Connor's over in the UK and we all have kids. You know, so I totally hear that. But
Bo did say he wants to come back. Whenever he feels that he has the time, because the problem with our episodes is they're so long. Like
they are pretty long, right?
He wants to do all these different things, like you know, what's happening in the community and what are we working on and what person, like there's all these different sections of the podcast and it just balloons into these 3-hour episodes and editing them takes four times the length of the episode. So it's just such a time investment. So whenever he feels that he has the time, I would love to start doing them with him again for sure.
Well, one thing that you guys do that I actually found so educational, just learning about the developer side, is you guys would go talk about the game and sort of like a review, you know, nothing too critical, but, and then you would actually talk to the developer, you know, it's like, I found that just as somebody who is brand new to the community, like so interesting and educational, because it's like, if you don't know what's different about NES development, if you have, you know, you're used to playing modern games or, you know, you've never thought about how to make an NES game like that, that was just so educational because then I could go play the game and I could see what they were talking about, why they made a certain creative decision that they did.
Yeah, I find that like the people who are making the games are what I enjoy the most. Like all the different personalities, like there are so many different people from different walks of life that for one reason or another, like making a game for the NES is their jam, and just learning about them as people and the, you know, the decisions they make when they are building these games. I love it, man. It's fascinating.
So we were talking earlier about Nintendo Age being gone. And I mean, it is, for people who don't know, it is gone. Like it got nuked from orbit. It is technically still online, but man, it is a mess.
What a mess.
I don't even know how you search for information on there anymore. Like it is.
You don't.
Yeah. It's like technically, I think it's all there, but I still don't know what that was about. I have a theory. The guy who bought it is just a collector and he just wanted to collect it. Like, and he just wanted to say, I own this, you know, and, but then he broke it.
I think he wanted to be some sort of definitive source, but when he realized how much work it was going to be to like actually maintain and set it up, he sort of half-assed and bailed.
I threw the whole site in the trash can. It's just crazy. But
yeah.
Yeah. God. So, okay.
He was
so
like,
now
don't
that
worry. It's all going to still work. And then like the next day it was like, nope, change my mind. Well,
like not only does it not work, like he broke it in the most complete way that you could break it. It's just like, God, it's so frustrating. It's funny. Cause I signed up after listening to your podcast forever. I finally signed up for a Nintendo Age account. And it was about 2 weeks before all that happened.
So. Oh, man. So you never got to experience, like, the good parts of it.
No. I was, like, I got in right at the end, right before the bus drove off the cliff.
The plane went down, yeah. Yep.
Right when the drama happened.
So now that Nintendo Age is gone, you know, you were saying, it just seems like the whole scene has been fractured across a lot of different platforms, Discord servers and Twitter and whatnot. Where does it one go now? Like, where do you go for, you know, if you, I mean, I guess I don't know if you need to talk about NES development that you're working on, but I mean, you know, if people have, are there still forums? Like, are there places that folks can go? Does Video Game Sage, is that a useful resource for developers?
For developers, I would say no. Me personally, I really like that I've sort of set up on Twitter. I followed, you know, you always seek out who's doing NES development, and then you'll see, you know, a lot of people that you follow liking a new person's tweet, and it's just fun trying to track everyone on Twitter. So I think right now, Twitter is where I personally get all my information for what's happening in the community. But when I have questions, if I need to like look something up hardware wise, the NESDev forum is still the definitive source for NES homebrew developers.
Okay.
There's a forum there that you can actually go and ask questions. I've had mixed results as far as feedback from that, but there's a wiki with all the actual hardware specs, and that's where I find myself going the most. If I forget what bit I have to set to put the sprites behind the backgrounds or something like that. So
yeah.
The NESDev forum is definitely the place. But I think overall, if you're just getting into it, trying to figure out where to go for homebrew information, I honestly don't have a good answer for you. If I didn't already follow and know all the people that I know, I wouldn't even know where to begin.
Right. Huh. Hmm. Yeah, the NESDev forums, are they welcoming to outsiders? I have heard mixed things.
I honestly, personally, haven't had a lot of success there. Some people are big on it. Me personally, I haven't had good experiences there, so I would say no.
What other projects are you working on? I got to ask you about Courier. Tell me about that. Yeah.
Yeah, so after we finished Any Escape, and John, who I keep referring to, was the artist for that game, it was the first game he had ever worked on. So he and I became really good friends, wound up taking some vacations together, went to London and Paris, and just all around great dude. So after we finished that game, I was like, so you're my artist now, right? Like, we're doing this. Because like, he's so good, and he's so easy to work with, and since he had no prior NES development experience, like he didn't really understand the constraints. So like his art, I think, looks unlike anything else that you see on the system, just because he didn't know any better when he was making them. But I asked him, like, what do you want to do now? Like, we did my escape room game. Do you have an idea of like something you want to do? And he was like, yeah, I have a dream project. Like, I have this idea of this cyberpunk adventure game. There's like hacking involved and like power-ups, and I was like, fuck yeah, like I'm in, let's do this. So he wrote up this design doc of you know, the progression of the game, what happens in each stage, and we just started working on it. So it took us about a year and a half. we finished the game. And when we finished it, I was like, this game is too good to just release on Kickstarter like we did for Any Escape. Like, we need to shoot for the stars for this. So we started reaching out to a few different big name publishers.
Okay.
Just to see, you know, what options we had. And I will say, just like trying to find someone to release games on modern consoles, trying to get publishers to reply to emails, it's why I'm bald. Like, I've pulled out all my hair because trying to deal with these guys is insane. So I can't get too detailed because a contract has been signed and it is coming out in 2023, but I can't get into specifics of who's releasing it and how and that kind of thing. So it's a very cool cyberpunk adventure game. Overhead, it looks kind of like Zelda as far as like the view perspective. It has really cool hacking mini games. I think it's the bee's knees, so I look forward to getting some feedback on that. We will be displaying it at the Midwest Gaming Classic. I don't know when this episode is going to come out, but at the end of this month, we will be showcasing the game there. So if you happen to be there, if this comes out in time, come check it out.
What's the name of the game?
The name of the game is Courier.
Awesome.
It's very inspired by Shadowrun on the Super Nintendo.
Oh, wow.
I know exactly the one you're talking about.
Very cool. Yes. Very cool.
And Johnny Mnemonic, that Keanu Reeves movie, very much in that sort of vein.
The only other one I was listening for on the like bingo of those kind of names was Syndicate.
Okay.
And so,
yeah, John's a huge fan of those games, so he definitely brought a lot of inspiration.
I gotta point out how, you know, again, for people who are interested in getting into NASDAQ and stuff, you haven't said that it's like the assembly programming language is what pulled your hair out. It's talking to publishers, it's getting promotion, it's, you know, it's,
yeah, the thing making about, the like, games is the easy part.
Right. And you know, everyone take a drink. When Matt Hewson was talking to us before, you know, he had a similar kind of point of view where that's a big part of the work is just like you never reached the ceiling of all the people who could find out about your game or about the work that you do.
Yeah.
It might feel like, oh yeah, that's it. I've told everyone. Everyone who knows NASDAQ knows about the game. Like, that's it. But it just keeps growing. And that's kind of, I think, testament to what you're saying about the golden age of where we're at. Like, there's just so much growth happening in the interest.
Yeah. And Matt Hewson specifically, he's been instrumental. Like, his posts on Twitter get so much interaction. Like, he's figured out the perfect way to like showcase, you know, in development stuff in an interesting way.
Yeah, he is very good at that.
Yeah. So I'm very thankful for him coming into this community because he's helping to elevate all of us. It's great.
Yeah. Well, he was our first interviewer, so we always mention Matt Hewson in conversation on, I think, every single podcast. So we always take a drink when we mention Matt Hewson. Yeah.
Nice.
You talked about possibly porting some of your games to mobile, or at least looking into that in the past. Are there other platforms besides NES that you might want to try developing games for? Have you had any interest in that?
So I will say my love for gaming is always in the retro vein. So I'm always sort of exploring other systems that I maybe weren't, you know, exposed to when I was younger. So in the past couple of years, I've gotten pretty into Commodore 64, which is also coincidentally using assembly programming language. So I've toyed with the idea of working on some stuff on Commodore 64, which would be awesome. I've thought of maybe porting some stuff to MS-DOS just because I love old PC stuff.
Wow. Okay.
But honestly, now that I have the avenue of releasing NES games on modern consoles, like, that is scratching such a huge itch for me because I had always, you know, when you release games on NES, you know, your friends and your like relatives are like, that's cool, but like, I don't have an NES. I want to play your games. So, you know, you didn't ever have a way to allow them to experience the stuff you're doing. So now that, you know, my games are on these new systems and I'm getting, you know, friends and family to finally be able to play them, like, I love having that avenue. So not having to even worry about modern console stuff anymore, that's already taken care of. That's great. So yeah, if I ever do look at other systems, it's going to be in the retro vein.
Yeah. Would do you play modern games? Anything?
I am getting more and more into them now. So for the longest time, I didn't really have a comfortable way to play them. I had a PC, but it's not in a great place to sit and comfortably play for long periods of time. And I had an Xbox, but it's not really in a great place. So I recently acquired a Steam Deck.
Ooh, nice.
And I am in heaven. Like, it opens up so many opportunities for me to check out all these games that I keep hearing about, but I haven't had the ability to play. So yeah, I'm getting into it, but I haven't in the past 10 years played a whole lot of modern games.
Yeah, I was a little wary of the Steam Deck, but man, I've heard so many good things about it.
It's insane how good it is. Like, it shouldn't be this good for $400. Yeah. It can handle everything.
Is it ergonomic when you pick it up? Because that was my thing with the Switch. It has those tiny little Joy-Con controllers. I had to get new controllers for it.
It's so comfortable.
It feels like a bigger Switch.
Really?
A friend of mine brought one to Sundance this year, and I messed around with it.
Yeah, it's about twice as heavy as a Switch. And I was a little worried about that when I first got it. When I picked it up, I was like, man, this is heavier than I expected. But not once have I ever thought, man, I'm uncomfortable when I'm playing it. It's fantastic. And it emulates up to Switch. Like, I'm playing Switch games on the Steam Deck. It's insane.
Wow. Probably still not as heavy as a Game Gear, right? All right.
It is pretty awesome.
So now that you are going to be releasing these games on modern platforms, let me ask you this. When you design your games, how do you anticipate people will be playing them on original hardware? Or, you know, a lot of folks play them on emulators now, or I guess now
some people on the podcast might be
some people on the podcast. But, you know, now you've got people who might just say, like, well, I'm just going to wait for it to come out on Switch. How does the platform that people play on and the actual hardware that they use, how does that kind of affect the way that you design the games?
Well, for the longest time, I was a physical only on the actual hardware kind of guy. I was like, if you want to play my game, get a Nintendo, get an AVS, get whatever modern equivalent, you know, there is of an NES. And that's the only way you're going to be able to play it. But I realized in the past few years that, like, there are a lot of people that are playing things in emulators, on, you know, Raspberry Pis, all these different ways that people are playing NES ROMs, you know, through emulators. So I definitely am way more open to that now. You know, I would love people to play it on a physical NES cartridge, just because I think that gives me the most, you know, satisfaction, putting a cartridge in a system, hearing the click and pushing the power button. And, you know, it just takes me back to my childhood. But I definitely understand that not everyone has the luxury of having the space or the means to have an old system laying around. So however people can play them now, I am on board. If you even want to play my game, I want to shake your hand. So thank you.
Does you were talking about that. Does Netscape on Switch, does it have touch controls?
I don't think so.
Don't think so. Okay. I was just wondering.
But I don't recall ever trying, so I'm not 100% sure.
Well, I thought it was really interesting how you released that game and it is compatible with the Super Nintendo mouse.
Yeah.
So when did that occur to you when you were doing Netscape? Like, you know, because that's one of those things where you were talking about the limitations of the NES and designing for that, and you know, you have this really limited controller. And
coincidentally, as I was working on Any Escape, a lot of chatter on Twitter started popping up about, you know, the Super Nintendo mouse and how people were essentially figuring out how to get it to work on the NES. So it just, right place, right time, I saw people talking about it and I was like, man, this would work really well on this kind of game. So I looked at the hardware specs and tried to figure out how to essentially do the code to make it work. And we actually started implementing it pretty early on. I think we had had one chapter of the game done, which is like a quarter of the way there. And I got it not working well, but working well enough to debut at MAGFest. I don't remember what year that was, maybe 2019. So it was super awesome. And honestly, to this day, it's probably my favorite thing that I have done in one of my games, because it feels so good using the Super Nintendo mouse in that game.
Yeah.
And then, that company that makes a modern version of that Super Nintendo mouse, Hyperkin, I think.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, trying to figure out why that one wasn't working, and trying to troubleshoot that and manipulating my code to where it would finally work with both. It was a good achievement. So
oh, wow.
I loved getting to,
that's very
to,
cool.
to work on that. I hope I do another game where that works.
Yeah, I was going to say, you do a lot of point and click and that kind of game. Is this going to be a thing moving forward? Are you going to have NES Super Nintendo mouse compatibility with that kind of game in the future?
Oh, yeah. If I release a point and click, let me say when I release a point and click, it'll certainly be a thing for sure. I mean, there's no reason not to. It's too much fun.
Do you have any other projects, other point and clicks maybe on the way?
Not on the way, only in my brain. The only other project, we just finished Courier and that's in the process of getting released, but, we were hired, and I don't know if you've heard of this game, this guy, Onyx the Fortuitous.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God. Claim, yes.
You know him?
Well, okay.
His
on.
Claim to fame is he's edited himself into like news segments to make it look like he's being interviewed. So sorry to cut you off. What were you saying?
We were talking about this guy ourselves. No, Bart, you totally brought this guy up. And I didn't even know
his name. I saw his movie at Sundance this year.
Okay. I really, really want to see it. But we were hired to make a game for this movie. So we're about halfway done with development. He sent us the script ahead of time. We checked it out. So it's coming along. It's not going quite as quickly as we hoped it would, but it's going to be a platformer, very Ghosts and Goblins-esque as far as theme. And yeah, it's going to be fun.
Wow.
So that's what we're working on right now.
I was talking about that game 2 weeks ago with Jordan Davis, and he was because I had spoke to, I guess, one of your partners at MGC last year.
Nice.
About it. And he was like, nobody knows what this is. And I was like, I love this guy. This is great. And then I found out that his movie made it into Sundance. And I was like, oh my God, I have to see it because I work the festival every year. And
yeah.
I got to see it. And man, I cannot wait for that game.
I was bummed. He put it up for rental for like a weekend, but I just happened to be in New York at that time, so I still haven't gotten to see it. So I definitely want to. I've heard good things.
I laughed my ass off. It was
the
very
script funny. Was awesome. So I definitely want to see how that translates into visual.
It's very fortuitous that you happen to be talking about this in the moment.
Yeah, we took a little bit of a break working on it, but we started doing a lot this past week. So seeing it come together is so much fun, man.
Do you have a estimated release date for it? Because I'll be first in line.
I think it'll be this year. But because we aren't releasing it ourselves, we were just hired to make the game,
sure.
And then they're going to do with it what they will. I don't know what their timeline looks like. We were hoping to have it done, by the time the movie came out, but the process just hasn't. Mm-hmm. I haven't done a lot of scrolling platformers before, so like figuring out the programming logistics of it has been hard for me. So it's been slower.
I hear Matt Hewson is doing a programming like side scroller thing at the moment and inviting people to look at how his progress is going.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's
he gave himself like a month to finish it. Like it's insane.
No, it's all over my Twitter feed and it's incredible to watch because like you're saying, engagement is great, but it's also like he's just really he makes this really great content as well.
Yep, he's a great guy.
I see some, maybe not all, but a lot of the homebrew games that are coming out now that are getting acclaimed as being games that I don't know if they would have been even like greenlighted as games in the 1980s for the NES because they would be too adult or too self-referential or like a type of humor that really was not what the NES was about. And when I hear you talk about those Sierra online games, those point and click, sometimes really, quirky humor, you know, Monkey Island kind of style things, which were really not what kids were supposed to be playing, quote unquote, at that time. I don't know, but like, I feel like there's this kind of wave of games that are coming out now in the homebrew community that are what grownups want to be able to play now, but through the lens of the games they enjoyed as, you know, a younger person. I don't know if that's something that resonates with you or you see that as a pattern.
Oh, for sure. I mean, being able to, and this just goes for game design in general, like being able to take everything we've learned about what makes a game enjoyable to play over the past 30 years. Because, you know, at the time, when during the NES's heyday, they were all just figuring it out, even games in general. I mean, there was the first system where you could actually have like a full storyline experience, like The Legend of Zelda, like stuff like that just hadn't been done before. So being able to take modern sensibilities, like being able to save whenever you want, or, you know, not writing down crazy long passwords to come back to your progress, just all these things, shorter games. I don't know. There's lots of things that we can sort of take into account that we know, okay, we can't do this. This doesn't really work. You know, there's a reason games started doing stuff like this. Let's not do this. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but yeah, I think definitely being able to take things that we were inspired by, putting them through a lens of what would make this idea good in a modern age on an NES. Like, it's like a weird full circle thing. It's really cool to be able to do.
Not only do I agree with you, I feel personally like, and I haven't played it too much yet, but my experience so far with Full Quiet has absolutely been that.
Really?
Where I am just noticing just like, what would you call them? Like quality improvements of just like how the quality of the game is in terms of how you play, how you engage with the game, how it just like has these little refinements that like nobody could have possibly known to include this in 1988. Like nobody could have thought like, hey, it would be nice to add this little affordance to the menu or have this little thing. It just seems like it's something that you had to have the benefit of hindsight to make that.
And
maybe I'm underestimating the developers of the day and whatever, but like it feels like it's through the lens of a modern 2020s gamer.
For sure. Yeah, just the opening of that game is phenomenal. Like, it is so cinematic.
It's very cinematic.
And a lot of modern games are, you know, and movies are doing that kind of thing where like you're playing it as it's sort of beautifully showing you the title of the movie or game or whatever. Like, when I played the opening of that game, I was honestly blown away. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah. So I only have a few more questions here. I know you have other homebrew and podcast groupies to go talk to, I'm sure. But, so somebody just starting out in NES game development, my advice to them would be to listen to your podcast. What would your advice be, just, you know, for maybe somebody who doesn't have time to listen to every episode of The Assembly Line? What would your just kind of like just basic advice be for somebody who wanted to just get started?
So I guess my first question would be figure out what aspect of NES game development you want to do. Do you want to do the programming? Do you want to do the art? Do you want to do the music? There are lots of different sort of specialties if you want to focus on one thing that you can look into. So I would look into, after deciding one of those, I would figure out, you know, what program you need to download and learn to start doing it. So if you want to do music, you would download Famitracker, which is a Windows program that is just essentially a tracker. So most musicians know what trackers are, but it's just a visual grid of music notes that you just place where you want. And then that could be exported to be put into a Nintendo game. If you want to do graphics, there's a program called NES Screen Tool that has the limitations of the NES inherently baked into it. So you can't screw it up. Anything that you can draw in NES Screen Tool is going to be and work perfectly on the NES. So you can get affluent with that. But if you want to get into the programming, even that in itself has too many options these days, because you can learn assembly language. And if you want to learn assembly language, I would recommend tracking down Brian Parker's Nerdy Knights tutorials. Yeah. They used to exist on Nintendo Age, but they're mirrored on a website called nes.science now.
Oh, wow.
So you can check them out there. But if you don't want to do assembly, you can check out the C tools that people have put together. And I personally, you know, I don't program in C, so I don't know where to go to track those down. But Doug Fraker, NES Doug, I don't know what his website is. You can pipe that in if you know it. But I think a lot of the C tools are by him, so you would probably go to his website to track those down. But if programming isn't your thing, there is the NES Maker software that you can download. I don't know what it costs. I don't think it's that much, but
I think it's like 30 bucks, maybe 35.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, but there's a learning curve. I mean, with any new program, you're going to have to figure out how to do it. But there are so many resources now to figure out how to do this stuff. And if you have questions, there are a million people on Twitter that you can just reach out to, and we're all more than willing to take the time to answer your questions, because at the end of the day, more people doing it equals more fun games to play. So if you have any desire at all to get into this stuff, quit putting it off. Just get to work.
Thinking about people who maybe do start and they might hit a wall and get frustrated, what is the most frustrating part of NES game development for you, and kind of how do you deal with that?
Yeah, my personal experience, the worst thing is, you know, you only have a certain amount of time to do graphical updates every frame. And if, you know, there's only a fraction of a second that you can put background updates into the game. So I always, every project I do, I seemingly run into the problem where I get flickering on the screen because I'm trying to update too many things at one time. And it's so frustrating because there's really no way of knowing how close you are to that threshold until you cross it, and then trying to figure out how to get rid of the flickering while keeping everything in the game that you want. So trying to optimize code and get everything to work within a single frame for the NES is the hardest thing in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay. Gotta know, what are some of your favorite homebrew games besides your own, obviously?
Well, I wouldn't put my own up there in my favorite list, other than maybe Leisure Suit Larry, just because it was my goal to get that finished. So seeing it out there is nice. But my top three are probably, I've been known to rave about some of Sly Dog Studios games. So the Mad Wizard is my favorite homebrew of all time. It's a lot of people consider it a little slow to get started, but I love the exploration, but it's not so much exploration that you feel lost. So I think it's sort of a very well-scoped game as far as layout of the maps. The boss fights are fun and the power-ups are really enjoyable. So I love that game. Another game he did was Candelabra Estacero, which is a dungeon crawler.
Yeah.
There aren't nearly enough dungeon crawlers on the NES. There are a few back from the NES's lifespan, but they're just too obtuse to get into and too difficult, honestly. So Candelabra Estacero is awesome. The controls are a little hard to wrap your head around, just because
I had some hesitation with it because I wanted to play that, and I felt like I just needed to sit down and learn the controls for a weekend.
Yeah, it's tough. You're holding two controllers, one in each hand, sideways.
Right. Yeah, nunchuck style.
Yeah, so, you know, one direction on the D-pad controls one character's attack, or the other controller attacks one character's defense. So it's a little hard to wrap your head around, but once you get it figured out, it is such an enjoyable experience playing through that game. Plus, you get to write down, you know, and draw out the grid map and figure out where everything is and where all the enemies are, because the enemies are in static locations and they don't respawn. So after you get all the enemies on a floor killed, you can just explore the floor willy-nilly to make sure you got all the secrets. Super fun game. But my third favorite, probably Jay and Silent Bob Mall Brawl.
Okay.
Being able to play through that game with a friend, I mean, it's just so well done. The controls are tight. It just feels good to play. Really good experience.
It is fun. It will kick your butt, though. That is a hard game.
Oh, yeah. But it saves your progress. So it's one of those other modern sensibilities. You don't have to start from scratch if you turn the game off. It saves what level you're at, so you can just pick right back up.
Yeah. Yeah, I was joking about your favorite games being your own. Matt Houston did a list of his like top five NES homebrew games, and two of them were his games. And somebody pointed that out on Twitter. He's like, hey, two of these games are yours. And he's like, yeah, and?
Yeah. Hey, that's his prerogative.
Yeah. So let me see. Okay, yes, yeah, so some of your favorite homebrewers. You talked about Rob Bryant, Sly Dog Studios. Anybody else who maybe is in the scene, who you really have an eye on? Anybody you might want to collaborate with in the future?
Collaborating is tough. For the longest time, I was doing just things myself, everything. But that became really overwhelming trying to get a project done. And I had to come to terms with, I'm just not as good at graphics and music as some of these other guys. So I sort of found, you know, John as my artist now, having him, I don't know, it makes everything easier. So I'm pretty set as far as who I want to collaborate with. Mm. But one project that I would really like to do, so Bo and John and I did that Beyond the Pins game, just a little jam point and click. Yes. I would like to collaborate with them again to do a full version of that game.
Yeah.
Like a full point and click experience. Cause that, I don't know. I think that game is super fun and it has a lot of potential.
Yeah. Point and click / bowling.
Yep.
That is a genre that I think you guys could just really, not a lot of competition in that particular.
Right.
Sense.
Yeah. We can get the top spot of that pretty easy.
Connor and Bart, do you guys have any questions for our guest here before we wrap it up?
No, I think we've covered quite a lot actually.
I think the only question I have that's remaining is, you've mentioned, you know, the King's Quest games and other kind of like PC games and how that was your kind of intro. I guess I'm just wondering why you didn't decide to make DOS games, or why you didn't decide to do that. It felt like that was a fork in the road where you could have decided, oh, I want to make like games for like early pre-Pentium processor.
Yeah.
You know, consoles or whatever. Like, is that something that ever entered your head, or is just like, was there, from my own experience, I don't think there's much of a scene there, or it's very fragmented and it's not really mm-hmm. as cohesive as the scene around NES homebrew.
I think it was purely a right place, right time kind of thing. You know, when I was after college, when I was starting to collect for the NES and the tutorials came out for learning to program for the NES, right around the same time that I was, you know, starting to wonder like, oh, how are games made? It was just sort of like a perfect storm of me being exposed to how to make games for the NES. So the fact that it's my favorite system, it's just sort of icing on the cake. Right. So being able to see my games on the shelf beside Super Mario 3 and Legend of Zelda, like it's mind blowing. Like I don't often enough stop and think about how freaking cool it is that I get to make actual games on this system. Like it's so awesome. So I have, you know, considered doing DOS stuff, but at the time it was just sort of, this is what was exposed, what I was exposed to. And honestly, I haven't looked back. Like it's continuing to grow year after year after year. And it just gives me more of a reason to stick around and keep doing it, because I don't want to miss out what's going to happen. I mean, it's just so exciting.
Me neither, dude. Absolutely.
All right. Kevin Hanley, thank you very much for being with us today. Where would you like our listeners to go to find out more about your work?
You can follow me on Twitter. I am at a ton of glaciers, which makes a whole lot of sense. Sorry, it doesn't make any sense. So yeah, look at me there. And of course, my website, congames.com. You can find me there. I don't update it a lot, but as I, you know, come out with new games and stuff, I'll definitely be updating it. And that's if I choose to self-publish games again in the future, that's where they will be sold. So those are probably the two locations where you can find the most information about me. And if you're getting into NES development and you want to send me questions on Twitter, don't hesitate. My DMs are open.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, thank you, sir, for being with us today. I had a lot of fun. This is a good talk.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been the Homebrew Game Club podcast. You can find links to our Discord, back episodes of the show, or other social media at homebrewgameclub.com. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HB Game Club. If you like the show, please help us out by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify,
or by telling all of your retro gaming friends about our podcast. If you have comments or a suggestion for a game that you'd like to hear us talk about, shoot us a message on social media. Discord is probably best. Or you can email us at homebrewgameclub@gmail.com. Our opening music is by Twee. You can find him on Twitter at TUI2A03, where you can also find a link to his SoundCloud. Our outro music is by Raftronaut. You can find him on Twitter at 0000Jordan. You can follow me, Nick, on Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, or Video Game Sage at Divertov. That's D-V-E-R-T-O-V. Bart is on Instagram as Clever Username Needed, no spaces, and Connor is on Twitter and Mastodon at C-O-N-O-R-N-A-S-H, also no spaces. Thank you again to our special guest today, Kevin Hanley, and thank you all for listening.
Great job, everyone.
Great job, guys.